This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Best is about the insight and the context that we get from our guests.
Top-notch, value-added, hot-off-the-presses news.
Bloomberg puts out thousands of news stories a day, but some really stick with you.
It's a great way to catch up on some of the stories you might have missed on the Bloomberg.
Stories you're not going to find in any other news organization.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories of the day, powered by 2,600 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries around the world.
I'm Denise Pelgrim, and on this weekend edition of Bloomberg Best...
This is the greatest dislocation in credit that we've seen since 2008, there is no doubt.
How to avoid coronavirus pain and come out ahead.
I like the U.S. equities that have a global footprint.
Investor Mark Lobius on investing in emerging markets right now.
You have to look at the business they're in. There's no honor among thieves, right?
And cybersecurity in the era of coronavirus.
All this and more coming up in the next hour of Bloomberg Best.
And work from home. A lot of us know about that now. WFH, as we call it. It was once seen a luxury for workers. Now it's actually a necessity for the companies that people work for. And the coronavirus pandemic could have a permanent effect on where people do their work from. Bloomberg's David Westin had a chance to ask the CEO of Cisco Systems all about it. He begins by asking Chuck Robbins about Cisco's WebEx video conferencing program and what kind of traffic Cisco is seeing.
Well, I tell you, first of all, David, thanks for having me on, and thanks for all that you guys are doing to report on this situation. Look, we've seen unprecedented volumes. We are critical infrastructure for working from home and the internet service providers that are servicing all of us who are trying to work from home. I'll give you some statistics. We launched both free cloud security offers and free WebEx offers. And in the first 24 hours of putting that offer out, we had 240,000 new users sign up. And this is a platform that, you know, before this crisis was running 300 million users per month. We are now at, we're doing 4.5 million meetings a day. That doesn't even include one-on-ones that are occurring on the platform. We're at 12 billion meeting minutes through March so far. And just to put it in perspective, in the United States during any one-hour period, we will do 100 million meeting minutes in just 1 hour in the United States right now. So we've seen incredible demand. I'll tell you, our teams are tired, but you know, when you're talking about a platform that is now trying to support 3 to 4 to 5 times the volume that it ever was built for 4 weeks ago, they've done yeoman's work, frankly, to be where we are.
So, Chuck, have you been able to identify any weaknesses in the system? Because no one was prepared for this sort of onslaught, none of us, anywhere, in any way, shape, or form. Have you noticed any weaknesses or any things that you can be improving? What are those weaknesses? What are you doing?
Well, primarily, David, it's just about capacity. And, you know, we have tremendous relationships with the large service providers around the world, and they've been incredible partners for us. We had one of the major ones in the U.S. We needed capacity this week. I sent him a text at 6 o'clock at night, and by midnight they had done the work and increased the capacity. So it's just related to that, and there are minor things that will happen during the day. You know, we need everybody to be patient as we're just seeing these volumes that these platforms weren't built for. I mean, I've joked with our team, I should have told you when we spec these technologies that you need to build them to have everyone in the world working from home. And clearly we didn't do that. But the team, I have to tell you, I am so proud of what our team has accomplished, because they're working 7x24. We're trying to put more resources with them because I'm worried about them right now, actually.
What's your own experience with working from home as a practical matter? Is that giving you a different perspective on actually the product you produce?
Well, first of all, I think we all like working from home periodically. I think we all miss the office tremendously. But, you know, for our employees, we've looked at this across three vectors, right? What are we doing for our employees? What are we doing for our customers? And what are we doing for our communities? And even from home, we're able to execute on all of that. So, you know, we have all of our employees are working from home. We've stated that we'll continue to pay our contract and hourly workers. We're doing a video meeting with all our employees every week right now, the entire company. And we have medical experts that are on where we'll do a Q&A. And we have 20, 30,000 employees joining these Q&A sessions just so we can keep everybody up to date on what's happening in the world. And it's working fine for us right now. I think everybody's anxious to get back, but I think right now it's working great.
So as you say, you've got your hands full right now, just getting day to day. But is it too soon to start thinking about longer term implications for your business, for the business overall? I wonder if everybody who has learned to work from home will necessarily go back to the office once we're past this.
Well, I think that the capacity and the ability to work from home will continue. And I think what this is helping people understand is that it's possible. And you can be productive from home. So I think that this will change how we think about it in the future. But it's too early for us to really understand. And I told our leadership team, we had a leadership all hands yesterday, and I told them, look, we're not going to understand any structural changes to our business until we get to the other side of this. So I'll tell you, David, the big thing that we're really worried about, beyond our customers, beyond our employees, are our communities. And you think about what's happening with our homeless communities, with those who are, you know, one financial crisis away from being on the streets. I mean, these are the people we have to focus on right now. And we've been working very hard in Silicon Valley with our public counterparts to actually try to make sure we're taking care of them as well.
Chuck, do you have a sense of what this means to Cisco as a business, just in terms of dollars and cents, revenue, costs, things like that? The demand is way up, as you've described, dramatically up. At the same time, are you concerned about the ability of some of your customers to pay?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, David, we're not worried about it right now. We're actually just trying to get through this crisis. And so whatever our customers need, we're prioritizing our supply chain capacity. You know, we historically would prioritize that by our biggest customers who were the loudest. And frankly, now we've put a whole process in place to prioritize our supply chain capacity for those companies who are in the middle of trying to solve this crisis.
And that was Chuck Robbins, CEO of Cisco, with Bloomberg's David Westin. And coming up, an increase in hack attacks as tens of millions work from home. If you have a Bloomberg terminal, you can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go. You're listening to Bloomberg Best. This is Bloomberg Best. I'm Denise Pellegrini. Well, you know, a lot of us are working from home lately, and as we do, that makes us and the companies we work for way more vulnerable to phishing and hack attacks. The CEO of CrowdStrike says his company is monitoring events carefully. Bloomberg's Emily Chang had a chance to ask George Kurtz about it. He's CEO of the cybersecurity company.
Well, great to be here, and we absolutely are. If you look at any time where there's chaos in the world, we typically see attacks increase, and I couldn't think of a more chaotic time than now. We're certainly seeing increases in phishing attacks with lure documents that talk about COVID-19. That talk about potential cures, that talk about financial assistance. And we're also seeing ransomware. This is a time when we're most vulnerable. You think about our hospitals and governments to be attacked by ransomware. So we're seeing that across the board. And it's a time where people need to be vigilant and continue to monitor their security systems.
So are you saying that from a cybersecurity perspective, we're more vulnerable than we've ever been in recent history?
Well, when we think about the vulnerability, most people are not home and people are out of the office. And typically what we've seen, you know, prior to COVID-19 is that during the holiday season, when people are off, the attacks increase. This is the perfect opportunity for people to be out of the office, right, when no one's watching their systems, which is one of the reasons like why companies like CrowdStrike have continued to do well, because we provide that 24/7 monitoring as part of our overall security solution.
Now, the World Health Organization has reported that they've been targeted, and yet some of these hacker groups have promised they won't target hospital sites, testing centers, healthcare organizations. And yet, are you seeing that as well?
Well, I think it depends on the group. I mean, you have to look at the business they're in. There's no honor among thieves, right? So someone may say they won't target and someone else will. I think you can't rely on someone's word who's trying to break in and extort you from a ransomware perspective, which is important. To have the very best security technologies in place to stop these attacks. And a big part of that is using technologies that are powered by artificial intelligence to identify attacks that have never been seen before.
What about all of this video conferencing that's happening, whether it's Zoom or Skype or Google Hangouts or FaceTime or House Party, any number of ways that folks are connecting, whether for home or for work? How protected are these conversations?
Well, when we think about these technologies, thank God they exist because they allow us to do what we're doing in a remote workforce. When we think about a remote user, and we've spent a bunch of time with our customers and actually provided some additional capabilities for them to protect their home users as an example, there's risk because in a home user system, it's not monitored. But at the same time, you may be using that because you're forced to log into a company VPN and you could potentially expose that network. So our customers have taken advantage of the Falcon for Home program that we've put together to protect those home users in a time of crisis.
Now, a point that's been raised is that some of these hackers, some of these bad actors could make their way in and then lie in wait for weeks, for months, and that we might not know they're there. You know, how long will it be before we realize the full extent of the fallout here?
Well, it could be some time, and that's the problem with many corporate networks. They don't have really good visibility to understand how long the adversary is on their network. And, that's an area where it could be 90 days, 200 days before anyone actually discovers them, if they're lucky enough to discover them, which is, a big part of having good visibility across the network and endpoint technology. So, it's just a matter of time. We've seen organizations where we've responded to a potential breach. We weren't in there beforehand. They called us up and said, hey, help us out. And the adversary's been there for a year or 2 years in some cases. So it all depends on the organization, but I'm sure we're going to see some fallout from this over a period of time.
Meantime, because of the situation, you've got lawmakers pushing for more vote by mail and more mobile voting. And yet critics are saying we're just not ready for that, especially when it comes to something as important as an election. What do you think?
Well, at some point, we're going to be all electronic in terms of voting, and it's going to be a process as we work ourselves up to that. Maybe this is a way to accelerate it. I think we've seen various states have some challenges as they put that together. But I think over time, I think everyone ultimately over a number of years is going to move to all electronic voting. And it's critical that we actually have the security of those systems locked down so that they can't be manipulated by external parties or outside organizations, some of the nation state actors that are out there. From my perspective, at least for now, a vote in by mail is fine. I mean, we've done that for a long period of time. And I think in a chaotic situation that we have today, we're just going to have to go back to the old school methods and hopefully just get through it.
Meantime, we're already hearing, from intelligence sources that the Russians are trying to sow discord and disinformation as a result of the coronavirus to take advantage, as you said earlier, of the chaos. Are there any state actors that you are most or more concerned about at this point?
Well, I think at this point, we can all agree it's a worldwide pandemic. And whenever there's a worldwide incident, every government is interested in gaining intelligence information and understanding what's happening. If you think about the ability to understand what a country's doing, how they're going to respond, are there companies that actually have a cure for this disease? Are there technologies that can help lessen the impact? These are all things that countries want to understand, and they're going to be very, very active across the board in trying to identify and gather this information.
The U.S. is now poised to have the most coronavirus cases in the world, and obviously the U.S., always a target. How much does this concern you, knowing that the United States still hasn't reached its full testing capacity, and President Trump is already talking about potentially reopening the economy?
Well, I'm certainly not a doctor, and I just have to observe what's happening, and it's really a terrible situation that we're all in. I think like everyone else, and everyone is just sympathetic to small businesses and people that are out of work. We're sympathetic to the impact of families, and we all want to get back to our lives, but we have to understand the risk this particular disease creates for everyone, and we just have to follow the right guidelines. So, from our standpoint at CrowdStrike, we put our employees all remote weeks ago. We've been fortunate enough to be able to operate as a remote company for many years since I started it. But many other organizations are not, and there's a huge economic impact. So, of course, we have to balance that impact with the health of all the people across the globe. And, hopefully we can push through and we can get through this epidemic and get people back to health and back to work.
And that was George Kurtz, CEO of CrowdStrike, with Bloomberg's Emily Cheng. And coming up, one well-known investor says don't increase your cash holdings right now. We'll hear from Mark Mobius, co-founder and partner at Mobius Capital Partners. He says U.S. multinationals with a presence in emerging markets could be poised for a good run. If you have a Bloomberg terminal, you can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go. You're listening to Bloomberg Best.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Denise Pellegrini. If there's one thing that's certainly keeping investors up at night right now, it's the prospect of losing money or losing more money, maybe I should say. But the other thing that may be keeping people awake at night is the prospect of missing a buying opportunity, especially in emerging markets. And Bloomberg's Heidi Stroud-Watts and Taylor Riggs had a chance to ask Mark Mobius. He's co-founder and partner at Mobius Capital Partners about this. And they start here by asking the well-known investor how he's coping with all this.
Well, what we're doing is getting rid of those stocks that we were not very excited about for one reason or another, you know, over the last year, and buying more of what we like. In other words, we're not reducing our holdings. We're not adding cash, but we're trying to find those bargains. Now, we know that we may not be at the absolute bottom. There's no question about that, because the studies we've done indicate that the average decline over the years since 1987 is about 50%. You know, that's normal bear market decline. So we're not near that in many of these countries. So we have to buy very, very cautiously. But I think it's a good time to be picking up some of the bargains and getting rid of those things that you're not so excited about. But the idea is not to increase cash too dramatically.
I want to get to your conviction when it comes to Indian markets. Given the record sell-off, are you still convinced that this is a good time to add to Indian positions?
Definitely. For those companies that have strong balance sheets, you know, are going to be paying dividends. And you must remember that many of these companies around the world, not only in India, are not going to be harmed that much by what is happening now. For example, broadcasting companies are going to be increasing their business because they're going to have many more viewers, many more listeners, that sort of thing. So we have to look at each company individually. But our excitement about India has not diminished at all. We think that it's a great time to be picking up bargains in these markets like India.
Mark, generally speaking, last year the trade of the year was U.S. versus rest of the world. As you take a look at this year, are you positive on U.S. equities or do you really prefer rest of the world?
Well, I like the U.S. equities that have a global footprint, and particularly those global companies that have a big footprint in emerging markets, because if they have a good, strong balance sheet, as many of them do, they'll be in a terrific position to pick up market share in these emerging markets as a result of the problems that some of the local companies are having. So I think it's a good idea to look at some of these multinationals in the U.S.
Are you able to give us a few names of those multinationals in the U.S. with big footprints overseas?
Well, by the way, talking about Alibaba, it's probably a good idea to look at Alibaba at this stage, particularly if SoftBank is selling, because the price, you know, may get weaker, and that it would be a good example of a company that's really becoming very global. Listed in the U.S., of course, Chinese company, and the Chinese market has not gone down very much. But there are a number of companies, multinationals, that are in the consumer business that are quite interesting that, you know, we should be looking at.
Mark, as you mentioned, China hasn't really lost very much at all. In fact, weirdly, maybe the equity market as well as the currency almost acting as something of a haven in this part of the world. Do you expect that kind of anchor role to continue? What do you like in the Chinese market in terms of, as you say, companies with good fundamentals that are going to be able to see out the other end of this still intact?
Yeah, the Chinese market, I think, is going to continue to outperform other markets because the Chinese government has taken measures to really prop up the industries and the companies. And I would say that companies that are in the technology area might be really interesting in China right now. I noticed that Onhai or Foxconn has got workers back to work. And that means that these companies are, you know, coming back again and, of course, trying to maintain their market shares.
What about Southeast Asia then? What sort of opportunities are you seeing in Vietnam, Indonesia? I mean, you sort of take your pick when it comes to valuations, and you have so many markets around this part of the world trading at pretty much distressed levels, right? Is it tempting to you at this point, or do you really need more visibility as to what happens at the end of this crisis?
No, it's very tempting. I think the way to look at it is this way. You've got to assume that we're going to have two quarters of no earnings or losses, okay? Once you plug those numbers to these companies and look forward 2 or 3 years when the recovery comes, you can see that even with those losses, the numbers look very attractive. So that's the way we would look at it. And you can find these opportunities in Indonesia, in Vietnam, Malaysia, Singapore, Thailand. You just name it. There are opportunities all over the place.
And that was Mark Mobius, co-founder and partner at Mobius Capital Partners. And coming up, massive disruptions in the credit market. What actually happened last weekend as some investors stared down into the abyss? If you have a Bloomberg terminal, you can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go. You're listening to Bloomberg Best. This is Bloomberg Best. I'm Denise Pellegrini. All right, let's take a moment to give credit where credit is due. I'm talking about the massive credit market and all that went down, starting especially last weekend when some investors and some companies really started to look at the prospect of not being able to get credit at all and the way that ricocheted through the investment community before the Fed stepped in. We had a chance to ask Bruce Richards all about it. He's chairman and chief exec over at Marathon Asset Management. Bloomberg's Vani Quinn starts here by asking him about what went down. Let's listen in.
Well, this is the greatest dislocation in credit that we've seen since 2008. There is no doubt. The shock to the system, large parts of the economy shut down. Goldman's forecast just a month ago was a negative 3% for Q2. It's now negative 24% Q2. That's how far we've come. Fiscal stimulus and the Fed's unlimited buying power will for sure take away some of that left tail risk that we've seen and being underpinning for much of the markets. So that's the good news. Fed will be in buying $1 trillion and then $2 trillion, potentially $3 trillion of investment grade corporates. And remember, investment grade corporates is a $7 trillion marketplace. So it's a huge, huge amount when they begin their buying program. We believe in the marketplace today, there's $1.2 trillion of distressed situations that exist in the U.S. alone. That's a staggering amount. That equals the entirety of 2008-2009 because the markets are so much bigger now compared to then. And so we've already seen that. There is about $100 to $200 billion of dry powder that exists in the marketplace, but that dry powder overwhelmed the $50 billion of distress that exists, say, coming into the year, because there's now $1 trillion plus in distressed. So our playbook is to buy the performing assets at deeply distressed prices, to buy senior in the capital structure, what we consider to be above the fulcrum for companies that have more risk, so that way we're in a safe part of the capital structure and we'll have a par recovery at from very deep discounted prices. And just generally, to buy high yield at 1,000 spread, that equates, we believe, when you normalize, to a 50% return over a three-year holding period, which works out to around a 16.5%, 17% annual IRR.
Okay, Bruce, so, let's just start unpacking some of this because there's a lot there, and this week must have been catnip to somebody like you, right, who looks at this for a living. And honestly, you've been waiting for this kind of event in credit markets, and obviously the human toll of what's happening is very much front and center. But for somebody like you who manages money, you know, you dive in at a time like this. So take us through, you know, what happened at the weekend and where you've actually begun making some decisions.
Well, thank you. I mean, to your prior point in that comment, Bonnie, you know, the priority for all of us is the health and well-being of our global economy and our global community at large. And my prayers go out to everyone, you know, those stricken and those we help, you know, and hope we're going to get through this and as we flatten the corona curve. And, you know, there is a tremendous, tremendous vacuum in liquidity that occurred. And so, you know, the old saying that leverage kills, well, it killed a bunch of parties that, use leverage and were forced to liquidate because they couldn't make their margin calls, and lower prices forced even lower prices and more margin calls. And so you have BDCs with one turn of leverage that were down 50 to 75%. But the biggest sellers were some of the leveraged mortgage players. So the mortgage REITs are typically, these are the financial REITs, are typically leveraged 4 to 8 times. And many of them are now insolvent because prices fell 20%. And if you're leveraged 5 times and prices falls 20%, you're wiped out. Major asset managers with public and private REITs now have to contend with this fallout. So we were getting calls at 10 p.m. on Saturday, 11 p.m. and 11:30 p.m. for Sunday bid lists because those margin calls weren't met on a Friday and those positions would be cleared out on Monday, but the dealers providing that financing had they not come up with the money by Monday morning. So they sold for next day settlement on a Sunday at 2 o'clock. Hundreds of millions, and the total number is actually in excess of $1 billion, but each party that was selling was hundreds of millions on these bid lists.
So
we're talking about AAA-rated structured credit bonds that were trading at 102 just a month and a half ago that were in the 80 to 83 price range, and we were in buying. And so a very smart CIO who just gave us this morning an allocation of additional $100 million said, hey, Bruce, give them the rope-a-dope, referring to Muhammad Ali. And what he implied by this is the market will exhaust itself as liquidations play through, and you'll be able to buy high quality at low prices, and when the selling stops, you'll win because you'll be at the top of the capital structure with these best-rated bonds at very distressed levels. So liquidity is completely broken down, Bonnie. Just in these last few days, we've been hearing reports from CEOs of asset managers, it hasn't come from our shop, but CEOs of asset managers and the investors that have direct access to the dealer community. So on both sides, that the bid-offer spread for treasuries has been over a point. That's a 1% bid-offer spread, which is unheard of. It's usually 1/32nd. So the bid-offer spread is about 32 times what it had been. In IG, those bid-offer spreads were 5 points. In high yield and leveraged loans and structured credit, as much as 10 points or no bid. And so the street used to run these big, massive balance sheets, like $250 billion of credit back pre-08. But in the last few years, with Volcker Rule and a lot of discipline, those balance sheets have been collectively among the street, $25 billion. Coming into this week, the balance sheets were zero. They're not taking risk. And so what they're serving as is a very good counterpart to clear as a clearinghouse as opposed to take it into the book. And so that's what's caused a lot of this dislocation. It's not their fault. It's the rules that are placed on them. Having said that, it's also the massive selling because the markets have gotten so big. And when everyone goes to the exits at the same time, it becomes a bit daunting. So that's what's going on in terms of liquidity and what happened this weekend.
Yeah, the sentences that you're coming out with, I mean, there's something phenomenal in almost every single one of them. We could stop at the end of every one and ask you. So talk to me a little bit more about what entities are now in deep trouble and what kind of, you know, prices you were getting. I mean, could you basically sort of just, you know, name your price for some of these products?
We could, and when you have a 10-point bid offer spread, you want to be on the bid, so you don't want to be lifting offerings. And so we were placing bids below the marketplace and getting hit. And lowering prices 5 points below where we think we would get hit and getting hit. And so we're talking about, you know, AAA-rated securities that are asset-backed or structured in nature, resi and commercial securitizations, and we're highly confident, highly confident that we'll be back at par on the back end of this, because when coronavirus clears and when everyone's back to work and the markets settle down, we're going to be left with a zero federal funds rate. Whenever you have a crisis, a recession, which we're certainly in, the Fed will never tighten, raise rates in at least 3 years subsequent to that point. And so we know in 2021, 2022, and 2023, with the highest level of confidence, rates are zero, and the Fed's balance sheet will have taken us from $4 trillion of treasuries, probably with these deficits, to $6 and $7 trillion of treasuries. And so rates will be locked in really low. And if we can buy 4, 5, 6% coupons in the 80s, that'll look very cheap at par. And so that's what we've been in buying most recently.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of the detritus this week and also how long you think it will take for this to all play out, Bruce. So what industries? You talked about some of the banking institutions as well. And, you know, we're obviously hearing the same thing, that there is going to be some real trouble, not in the big banks, but maybe more regional banks and non-financials. Can you give us more detail there and what you're doing?
Certainly. So there are sectors to avoid. The big banks, you know, starting with J.P. Morgan and Bank of America and Citi and other large banks, are healthy. They've come in very well capitalized. Now, they'll be a little less well capitalized because all the revolvers have been drawn, and, you know, there's going to be some losses that come through in terms of loans when, you know, the consumer base in credit cards, in auto loans, in home loans have some type of forbearance for a certain portion of that portfolio. But we think the banks will come through healthy because they have behind them this enormous backstop, which is the Fed, which is providing all kinds of liquidity to the banking system. So we don't think the banking system is at risk or is an issue whatsoever. The bigger risk is some of these, you know, non-bank financial companies in the financial industry. And so we're avoiding those companies. They're independent, non-bank finance companies. It can be anything from, again, the REIT or the BDC to the, you know, finance company that provides consumer finance, and not to mention specific names. I would just be very, very cautious. I'd also be cautious in anything that's oil and gas. It should not be funded with debt. It should be funded with equity. It's going to be a disaster for oil and gas. There's going to be everything from the fallen angels, those that are the strongest ones that are rated triple B that will fall to junk, to a lot of the private companies got funded and the frackers that just won't be able to make it through this cycle. And so it's going to be, you know, pretty disastrous for the community of Houston and for the energy sector, you know, at large. Discretionary retail will also get hurt, and particularly, you know, travel and leisure. And so, you know, receiving government bailout money is a good thing because it will help them get through, but it'll be highly dilutive to equity prices and the equity itself. And so we think that it'll look more like AIG. It'll take them years to work out of it, as opposed to just because the government's coming in, you think you're going to make a lot of money on that going forward.
Bruce Richards, Chairman and Chief Exec over at Marathon Asset Management. And as we head into a new week, investors, of course, will be watching Treasury Department and Fed efforts to keep some of the especially troubled portions of the credit market liquid. And that's it for this hour of Bloomberg Best. If you have a Bloomberg terminal, you can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go. I'm Denise Pellegrini. This is Bloomberg.